Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
You know, in Africa, we don't see youths coming to political leadership. So he requested people in the podium to allow youths in their administration and so that they can exercise their political and democratic rights.
Africa Union's Heads of State Summit begins in Ethiopia Saturday.
The violations have been intensified before the 2001 election, during and after, and therefore we need to capture this period for a proper inquest so that we can have to hold this regime accountable.
Uganda's opposition parliamentarians plan a series of protests against human rights abuses.
It's very important to have, first of all, the structure, then to have the people who have experience, who teaches them, and because that's what they need. And but there is, like how I said, is you have to work together. You have to find together a solution.
And Sierra Leone's President Julius Maada Bio appoints English Premier League soccer star Antonio Rudiger as brand global Sierra Leone football ambassador. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The African Union Heads of State Summit is underway in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa Saturday. The chairmanship of the African Union Assembly of Heads of State, the continental body's highest decision-making body, rotated from President Felix Tshisekedi of the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, to Senegalese President Macky Sall. The Senegalese leader says his key focus will be on ways to help address the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. This includes working to secure access to vaccines from overseas while stepping up efforts to expedite the manufacture of vaccine in Africa. For the latest development at the ongoing summit, I reached reporter Gelmo Dawit at the conference center in Addis Ababa.
So the heads of the states of African nations have gathered and discussing about the COVID impact on the African economy and the peace and security sector as well. So today, in the opening, the chairperson of African Union, Moussa Fakias, addressed the session. He majorly raised about the impact of COVID on the African economy. He also raised about the lack of vaccination across Africa and appreciated the establishment of CDC operations here in Addis Ababa and requested the nation to fasten the construction of the CDC headquarters here in Addis Ababa so that it will get into producing vaccines whenever pandemic like COVID-19 happens in all over the world or in Africa.
Gelmo, what about the issue of security concerns on the African continent, especially with the recent coups, four at least, three in West Africa and one in East Africa? What did he say about security concerns on the continent?
Yes. He raised about these coup problems, which he termed as the unconstitutional form of gaining power or coming to power. So for these things, especially as you raised, so many coups have been happening mainly in Western Africa, he raised two topics majorly. So he said such coups or unconstitutional form of coming to power across Africa are happening due to lack of coordination between regional blocs and Organization of African Union. So he blamed that and called on the regional bloc to closely work with the African Union and settle the matter. The second thing is, whenever the coup happens in some countries in Africa, they use their own sovereignty as a pretext or a scapegoat. So he called on all the leaders of the African nation in the podium to stop such incidents.
I understand Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed addressed the heads of state. He's seeking reforms at the UN Security Council and wants Africa to have a permanent seat, as well as some political issues in Ethiopia. Give me an insight into what he said today.
Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed began his speech regarding the impact of COVID-19 on African continent and again the security problem in the Horn of Africa region. So majorly for himself, he requested other African nations to echo to seek permanent seat at the UN Security Council. As you know, Africa has no permanent seat at the UN Security Council, so he requested the leaders of African nations present in the podium to echo his request for Africa. So secondly, he raised about the political tension and the security problem in his country, Ethiopia. As you know, the conflict in North Ethiopia is now going for 15 months. So he said his government is doing its best to curb these things amicably. He also raised about the release of political leaders from jail recently. And he also said about the Ethiopian national dialogue set to happen within the country in the coming time.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres also addressed the heads of state. What did he talk about?
So, majorly, Antonio Guterres talked about the support of UN for the African continent regarding the green economy. So, you know, Africa has been affected by the climate change. So he said the UN is ready to support African green economy so that it will stand out against the impact of the climate change. Secondly, he raised about the security and the political instability in Africa. Majorly, you know, in Africa, we don't see youths coming to political leadership. So he requested people in the podium to allow youths in their administration and so that they can exercise their political and democratic rights.
That was VOA's reporter Gelmo Dawit. He spoke with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, main opposition leader Martin Fayulu says the presence of foreign military in the country is an attack on the country's sovereignty and an affront to citizens. This as the joint military offensive between the Uganda People's Defense Force, or UPDF, and the armed forces of the Democratic Republic of Congo, or FARDC, intensifies its operation against the Alliance of Democratic Forces, or ADF militants. But Fayulu says it is wrong for the country to outsource its key constitutional mandate to protect life and property to others. He's also opposed to the presence of Rwandan forces in the DRC. Supporters of the government say the joint military offensive against ADF rebels is a welcome development to ensure the protection of life. They also praise efforts by the government to work with its international and regional partners to combat insecurity in parts of the country. Martin Fayulu, the DRC's main opposition leader, tells me that the main causes of insecurity in the country must be addressed.
To start with, let me tell you this. Mr. Tshisekedi's actions in allowing foreign troops into our country were unconstitutional from the outset. As everybody knows that last May, Tshisekedi secretly signed two military cooperation agreement with Uganda. Despite public outcry, just 1 month later, he did it again, signing three cooperation agreement in Rwanda. Now, we cannot forget that these two neighboring countries were involved in mass killing and the systematic looting of our natural resources less than 20 years ago and since that time. The presence of foreign armies on Congolese soil is not only an attack to the sovereignty of our country, but it is an affront to the Congolese people in general, and to the inhabitants of Kisangani, particularly many of whom still carry the physical and emotional scars on the 6 days war.
But Mr. Fayulu, why are you saying the agreement is illegal? Because MONUSCO backs the joint military offensive between the FARDC and the Uganda's UPDF because they are going after the rebels who have been causing mayhem.
You know, I'll come to that. But let me say this. A well-governed state doesn't not outsource its security to others. Instead of mortgaging our sovereignty and our dignity to countries whose crimes against our people are well documented, and internationally recognized. We must address the root causes of instability. In my opinion, that starts with national reconciliation, justice, and the end of impunity for serious crimes. But as far as MONUSCO is concerned, I don't think that what MONUSCO is doing now is the way to go forward, because MONUSCO has been there, has been in this country for several years with all a lot of means. Why until today the killing of Congolese continue in the eastern part of the country? This is the question we are asking. And let me say it again, without the political will and a legitimate government to eradicate this phenomenon, there will be no solution that satisfies the Congolese.
Do you think reconciliation is the best way forward to address the growing insecurity in the country, especially with Congo having a plethora of different armed groups?
Yeah, we have many rebel groups, but those rebel groups are coming from where? Who is behind them? Who's backing them? That's why we need the government. We need to fully assess the situation and find the solution. Of course, we need the strong relationship and to collaborate in a good faith with our trusted neighbors. But we must first and foremost equip our valiant soldiers properly so they can defend our nation in line with globally recognized best practices. You know, similarly, those who have illegally siphoned off resources meant for our soldiers must be expelled from the National Army and from our security services. We have many people in the Army. We have many people in our security services. They have nothing to do with the country. They are there because some people send them to work for them.
Martin Fayulu is the DRC's main opposition leader. He spoke with me from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa. The leader of the opposition in parliament says the group plans a series of protests against human rights abuses and the use of public institutions to intimidate and harass opponents of the administration. Attorney Mathias Mpuuga, the minority leader in the Ugandan parliament, led the opposition walk out to protest what he says is the torture, abduction and detention without trial of citizens. He says there is evidence that supporters of the main opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP, and critics of the government are being arrested and held in detention without trial. The group is also demanding the release of all opposition supporters arrested during the recent general election. But supporters of the government say the opposition failed Ugandans by refusing to use parliamentary channels to address their concerns. They accused Mpuuga and opposition parliamentarians of engaging in a publicity stunt. Thomas Tayebwa, chief whip of the majority in parliament, says his team is willing to engage the opposition to address their issues and concerns. Parliamentary minority leader attorney Mathias Mpuuga tells me that he plans to table a motion in parliament to demand answers from the government about human rights abuses in the East African country.
We have been over the last 6 months bringing to the House of Parliament concerns of the citizens all over the country relating to various forced disappearances of citizens, including illegal arrests and detention without trial, torture, extortion of money from families of arrested family members and the military. And all these are falling on deaf ears. So we said enough is enough. I rose and mobilized my team to protest this state of non-responsiveness, as well as increased intolerance by the regime of people opposed to its methods of work. So it's a crowback by protesting that we are not going to accept. And I can assure you, that's just the beginning of more protests against regime brutality and intolerance in this country. And we're not about to stop.
Now, so what is the significance of Thursday's protest? Because all along you've been attending parliamentary sessions while some of these alleged infractions that you talk about have been happening or continue.
Of course, when you raise them, ordinarily you expect the serious government, serious political leaders to respond by either providing answers. Remember when our colleagues, two members of parliament, were arrested and detained without being produced in court? We protested and they were produced in court. Forget about the facts that their charges we contend are trumped up. But for us to make sure that these issues of torture are not being let to go and look as if they are normal things, as members of parliament, we needed to rise and have this debate back in the public domain, the public arena, so that the public rises with us to oppose torture, to oppose militarism, to oppose a set of impunity that is taking root in our country. So it doesn't matter when. Anytime we rise, tomorrow or yesterday or another day, does make a lot of sense, because the regime is used to not being challenged. And we're saying that time is no more.
How justified do you think this protest action is? And do you think it will have any desired impact? The reason why you embarked on this action?
You know, Peter, we are part of the international community. And Uganda is a signatory to several international protocols on the rights of the people. And therefore, even in Uganda, we have several domestic legislations against torture, against extrajudicial killings. As part of the family of nations, we believe this is going to impact, because then Uganda must account to the family of nations of how it does treat its citizens. We can no longer afford to be a country on our own, because the regime has to explain. If it wasn't impactful, wouldn't be discussing this on the VOA. That's how serious it gets. So the regime will have to be exposed and allowed to account for every killing, every act of torture, every disappearance of a citizen must be accounted for. So we are bringing exposure of the regime to the family of nations to have them account for their actions.
What do you say to those who are saying the reason why you embarked on this protest and for which you are planning a series more should have been addressed in parliament? So you'll use parliamentary channels to address your concerns.
Certainly they are entitled to their opinion, but we are not about to take other people's opinions. We have our own approach. We have been here longer probably than their perceptions, and therefore we contend and understand the kind of language the regime best understands. That's not to say that the parliamentary channel is a closed chapter. When we resume House sittings, we intend to table our motions to cause a detailed inquest into human rights violations in the country, probably over the last 36 months, because the violations have been intensified before the 2001 election, during and after. And therefore, we need to capture this this period for a proper inquest so that we can have to hold this regime accountable.
Attorney Mathias Mpuuga is the minority leader in the Ugandan parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Meanwhile, the Uganda Law Society is recommending the disbandment of the anti-corruption unit at the State House. Instead, in its latest report, the lawyers group calls on the government to strengthen the Inspector General of Government as part of the effort to weed out corruption in public institutions. The Inspector General, the lawyers say, is the only constitutionally mandated institution to fight corruption in the East African country. The newly released document, referred to as Rule of Law Report 2022 Fourth Quarter, cites details of practices against the rule of law in the last few months of last year. It also calls on top government officials not to interfere with the work of the Inspector General in the fight against graft. For more about the report, I reach Fiona Nabasa Wall, president of the Uganda Law Society.
We release quarterly rule of law report, and the last quarterly rule of law report was speaking about the current process by government to streamline agencies and reduce the public expenditure, because the agencies that are duplicating each other's roles, and you find that they're crowded in the same space, and sometimes the constitutionally established institutions are affected in the way they do their business. Now, we have not had an inspectorate of government for about 2 years, they've now just been, you know, recruited an IGG and deputies. And we think that as a move in this rationalization process, we think that the State House Anti-Corruption Unit, which was set up some time back to fight corruption, should be looked at seriously. One, we found that sometimes their work affects the work of agencies like the IGG or Ombudsman, which is a constitutionally established institution.
Fiona, I understand where you're coming from, but the Law Society has existed for some time now. The Anti-Corruption Commission has existed for some time now. Why now?
It's not the first time that we've actually asked for this. We realized that at the beginning of last year, we had a lot of skirmishes with the State House Anti-Corruption Unit, where a lot of advocates were being investigated and sometimes arrested and accused of crimes, when in actual fact it was because they were dealing in civil cases and some influential people were beginning to use this unit to persecute our lawyers for doing their work. So that is when this argument of why is it relevant came up. But as I've said, our IGG was not very effective because that time we didn't have a Human Rights Commission chairperson, we did not have an IGG head, and these institutions were more or less just existing in limbo. So the anti-corruption unit was very relevant in those 2 years to a certain extent, although we also saw how it could be misused to interfere with government, with other things like prosecution. So we had an EGM as the Law Society, and some of these issues were raised. And in this particular quarter, we were looking at the proposals by government to rationalize and streamline agencies. So it was our proposal that it be considered as one of those agencies that can be taken out of commission to allow already existing agencies to work properly without interference or duplication.
Some people have expressed concern that the Anti-Corruption Commission appeared to be used by the powers that be or influenced politically to go after opponents or critics of the administration. Is this assessment accurate?
I would not speak to its accuracy, but I'd be remiss if I did not say that when an anti-corruption unit, you know, comes from the State House, and the question then begs, can everybody, even maybe opposition people, benefit from it? And then maybe if you look at the prosecution, and I have told you that, for instance, my members of the Law Society, some of them seem to have been prosecuted or targeted because of the work they were doing, not necessarily political work, but also commercially work of a commercial interest, where you find that maybe their practice rivals, the people that are on the other side of the case, are coming up with criminal charges and using the anti-corruption unit to prosecute these people. And be abused. But we think that offices which have not been properly established by the constitution or by statute are even more so likely to be abused.
Fiona Nabasa-Wall is the president of the Uganda Law Society. She spoke with me from the capital, Kampala.
Relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music, and Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Sierra Leone's President Julius Maada Bio has appointed English Premier League soccer star Antonio Rudiger as Brand Global Sierra Leone Football Ambassador. The president also presented Rudiger with a diplomatic passport at a ceremony at the State House in the capital, Freetown. Antonio Rudiger, a tough-tackling central defender, is regarded as one of the best and toughest-tackling central defenders in the world. He is a Sierra Leonean German who plays for the Chelsea Football Club in England and for the German national team. Meanwhile, Rudiger has also launched the Antonio Rudiger Foundation in Sierra Leone, which he says has four priorities for sports. They include infrastructure, education, inclusivity, and literacy. I reached Antonio Rudiger in London via Skype. In part one of this two-part interview, I began by asking Rudiger about his trip to Sierra Leone and his role as a Brand Global Football Ambassador.
Yeah, the experience was amazing reception. I didn't expect that, to be honest. You know, because, I just don't expect that, because for me, myself, I am just a normal person like anybody, you know. And I was very amazed. And also like the people on the ground, like it was fantastic. And then the launching of the foundation, the meeting with the president, like it was overall like, wow, like crazy.
Before we go to the launch of your foundation, you met the president. The president was happy about the contributions you've made to Sierra Leone and the people. He said the people watch you all the time, wishing you and pray for you. Now you have become the sports ambassador for Sierra Leone. Talk to me about the experience.
I think this is something very huge because a president to say such meaningful words to a person, this is like, what can you wish for more? Like at the end of the day, like this is a big honor, and to receive this type of role that I received, the sports ambassador, this is also something huge. So it shows that that helping is very good.
So let's talk about the launch of your foundation in Sierra Leone. Talk to me about it.
Yeah, like it was our idea for me and my team to do the first launching of the foundation. I think it would have a bigger impact if you do it on the ground in Sierra Leone. And launching the foundation, it's to me personally very important because it's not a one-man show. This is what I want to make very clear. It's not a one-man show. I don't want to come out there as a hero or something like this. No, I want people to join, and because I think with the more we are, the more we can create. This is what I believe in. And obviously on the foundation itself, I have four very important stuff that we are focusing on. That's number one, sports education and in general education. Number two is sports infrastructure. And number three, sports inclusivity. And the fourth one is literacy. This
right.
is four key points we are looking at.
Let's take them one after the other. You talked about education in general and then sports education. Why that? Why are you so passionate about that?
Yeah, because I strongly believe that education is big key, because for me, the mindset, the head is the strongest weapon a human being have. So that's why it's to me very important. Unfortunately, people in the past, because we had the civil war and everything, so some people over there, we have to say it in real talk, are not well educated, cannot read, cannot write, or cannot speak proper English. So this is a very important thing, that because the youth is our future. So that's why it's very, very important to teach them.
Mm. And then talking about literacy, language and digital and numeracy, for the especially the disabled and the vulnerable children, why that?
It's not only about that, it's also women. That's also going to gender. It's because I went there to watch a game of amputees playing. You see the love they have, the passion they have, but unfortunately, they have one arm less or one leg less. But still, there's love for the game, so you have to always get them involved, and so you don't put them as outstanders. No, they also can be very, very important, and yeah, that's why.
You went there, you looked at some games about the disabled people playing. Sports infrastructure is developing, let's put it that way. How will your foundation help improve upon that?
Oh, it's like not only this, like how this comes to sports infrastructure. Like, if they have better pitches, better coaches, and people who really actually like care about them for real, we can go ahead. And that's why it's very important to have, first of all, the structure, then to have the people who have experience, who teaches them, and because that's what they need. And yeah, but there is, like how I said, is you have to walk together. You have to find together a solution.
Antonio Rudiger is English Premier League soccer star who plays for Chelsea Football Club. He spoke with me from the British capital, London. A civil society group is calling on the Nigeria Broadcasting Commission, or NBC, to reverse punishment it imposed on Vision FM based in the capital, Abuja. This after broadcaster regulator NBC imposed a fine and suspended a Hausa broadcast for discussing national security issues. But the Civil Society Legislative Advocacy Center, or CISLAC, condemned the punishment as yet another move by the government to clamp down on free speech guaranteed by the Constitution. Awal Musa Rafsanjani, executive director at CISLAC, who is also the head of Transparency International Nigeria, says it is unacceptable for the NBC to suspend a radio show and impose additional fines. He tells me that top government officials should not use state institutions such as the NBC to clamp down on the civil liberties of Nigerians.
We condemn this action by federal government because it is a calculated attempt to clamp down on the press freedom and freedom of expression. This is also part of the, you know, calculated attempt to silence Nigerians and to make them completely ineffective in governance. So we condemn this attempt to even fine this radio station because we think that government is, you know, some government agencies are getting out of, you know, tolerance, and the impunity at which they are conducting themselves is undermining democracy and freedom of expression and choice.
But why do you think the action taken by the government is improper? Because there were worries that the program could have degenerated into disaffection among people and created tension.
There's nothing that was done that is illegal, and there was nothing that was done that, you know, tantamount to breaching the security in the country. I think it is just the intolerance, and because some government officials, they don't want Nigerians to know what is going on. They don't want corruption to be exposed. They don't want bad governance and impunity to be exposed. That is why they could take this action. Otherwise, there are several radio stations and newspapers that, are also broadcasting, and that they are also facing similar, you know, threats from the authority, which we consider as total attempt to silence Nigerians from knowing what is going on in government. And that I think, you know, it is important that the Nigerian government suspend or remove this attempt of finding this radio station, and also the suspension that they have placed on the program. It is important that Nigerian officials understand that the more you cage people, the more you block them from knowing their rights, the more you, deny them, access to credible information, you will, create a room for rumor, and suspicion will continue.
But the National Broadcasting Commission said it imposed the fine on the station and suspended the program for discussing issues about a national security agency. You know, the government is sensitive about that, especially when it has come under criticisms for the alleged growing insecurity in parts of the country. And that is why the National Broadcasting Commission had to take action.
This is not an excuse. I think it is rather an excuse to further undermine freedom of expression, you know, and also cage press freedom in Nigeria. I think, you know, the best answer to whatever issue that government thinks is to ensure that the insecurity in the country is addressed. Every day, you know, Nigerians and international community, they talk about insecurity in Nigeria. They talk about police, they talk about various security agencies, you know, and calling them to take responsibility to ensure that they secure the country and the people of Nigeria. I don't see anything that has been discussed, that has been done, that will undermine, you know, government or its institutions. Maybe some individuals who have issues, who do not wish Nigerians to understand and expose wrongdoings in various government institutions, are the ones that are determined and using this just to hide under the cover of security. Otherwise, Nigerians already are, you know, in serious insecurity threat. Not even threat. In fact, Nigerians are actually suffering from insecurity in Nigeria. And what government need to do is just wake up and take its responsibility by tackling those people who are promoting or those who are conducting insecurity in Nigeria, rather than just fixing their anger on people who are demanding for accountability on how they do things.
Awal, do you see the NBC reversing its decision, pay your call? And how soon do you think that decision could be taken? And if it's not taken to reverse course, what would the organization do?
The NBC should listen to Nigerians, and Nigerians, of course, the country have spoken and condemned this, you know, action. And if they care about democracy, about the freedom of expression, I think they should be able to respond positively to the yearning and aspiration and call of Nigerians, you know, on this matter. Failure to do that, it shows the growing impunity, but that will not also, you know, be sustainable, because a lot of Nigerians will continue to demand for justice, for accountability, irrespective of this action.
Awal Musa Rafsanjani is the executive director of CISLAC, who is also the head of Transparency International Nigeria. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera is warning his newly constituted cabinet against engaging in corruption. He announced his policy on ethics and his expectations of behavior during the swearing-in ceremony in the capital, Lilongwe. Mr. Chakwera dissolved his old cabinet following pressure from civil society, religious and opposition groups. They accused some of the former ministers of corruption and being ineffective. The groups demanded the president keep his promise to reshuffle the government after the first 5 months. But analysts say President Chakwera kept on more than 70% of his old cabinet, which they argue will fail to meet public expectations. For more reaction about the Malawian president's newly assembled group of advisors, I reach Ernest Lamek Thindwa, a leading member of the Political Science Association of Malawi.
Most Malawians, what they expect is much more is about improvement in service delivery, but I don't think they have much hope that there will be significant improvement. For the mere fact that the reconstituted cabinet is basically the reinstatement of the previous cabinet. There has been very few changes in terms of the cabinet. The majority have been retained, and therefore, I don't think most Malawians expect a better performance for this current cabinet than the previous one.
There are changes, there are new faces, and there was a reshuffle. For example, the foreign minister Eisenhower Nkaka, who is a prominent member of the ruling party, has been assigned to a different portfolio from the foreign ministry. Why do you doubt that service delivery will still remain poor?
The expectations of Malawians was not about merely changing people from one ministry to the other. The expectations was to make significant changes in terms of cabinet personnel, which has not happened, really. People who have been dropped from the previous cabinet are about six or thereabouts. So over 20 have been retained. And that's the worry of most Malawians, because they didn't have much faith in the majority of cabinet ministers in the previous cabinet, because in their view, they don't deliver to the expectations. The fact that they have been retained, much as they have changed ministries, doesn't give Malawians much hope.
The president warned the ministers that he will not spare the rod
if there is evidence of them committing acts of corruption and all that. What do you say to that?
The statement was welcome, but it's not the first time the president has warned his ministers about his intolerance of corruption. Even at the time of the sworn in 2020, he issued the same warning, but here we are. A couple of ministers have been alleged to have been involved in corruption, and they have been dropped in their previous cabinet. And recently, another one has been dropped, meaning since he's coming to power, he has dropped about three cabinet ministers on the basis of being suspected of being involved in corruption. So the warning by the president has been there, but that has seemed not to deter ministers. Ministers seem to continue getting involved in corruption, and it will be extremely difficult given the political environment in Malawi and looking at how pervasive corruption has been in Malawi. It will be extremely challenging for ministers to keep corruption at bay. What will be most important is action by the president. By action, I mean the president demonstrating that he will not shield anybody, not where you have a minister being alleged by a government agency fighting corruption and is still being retained for over a month. That does not send a good signal. One would expect the moment a minister is mentioned by an agency fighting corruption, immediately he should be asked to step aside. That has not been the case, unfortunately, in the recent days. And that is where demonstration of commitment to fight corruption may be questioned by the president.
So you think these brand new ministers who were just sworn in this week might not necessarily have a significant impact in service delivery in Malawi?
Absolutely, because the majority of the ministers have been in the cabinet for now over 1.5 years. And in 1.5 years, there has been enough time for them to demonstrate that they can deliver. But if you ask most Malawians, I don't think they would be impressed.
Where does President Chakwera and his team go from here? Because even Vice President Dr. Salos Chilima, some of his positions were taken away in this new cabinet.
Absolutely, absolutely. For me, what is significant is for the president to tell the public what are the performance targets for each ministry and each minister, and use the same to gauge ministers. But as it is, we don't know what are the performance standards that have been agreed between the president and cabinet minister. As a result, it becomes difficult sometimes to assess whether ministers are doing relatively well or not. But in terms of service delivery, people are the best judges. But as I'm saying, what would be key is to make performance targets or performance standards clear to ministers and clear to public, so that both the public and the president have a basis against which to measure the performance of each ministry and each minister. That seemed not to be the kind of management approach being adopted by the president.
Ernest Lamek Findwa is a leading member of the Political Science Association of Malawi. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Blantyre. Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Kanje tuba furkwanje nokuri nareme dori kirere kira tuje kukawio we no mama tujaho batazi. Chanyewe, oruko wangise, da kureba nisetsa kizabusira cyasha nukuri naremwe wowe ura umuntu tumwe singi namahwemo fati kiganza nungekure shema Konzisa, oh my darling.
Oh yeah.
Gukundwa nawe n'umunyenga. Yeah. Indukuvuze mama, ndumvumpamagara.
Yeah.
Mama yo.
Your love and your prayers. Oh, Africa. chipiri pa killere rata savana. Didi chipiri pa killere rata bato. Didi chipiri pa killere rata savana. Didi chipiri pa killere rata bato. Didi chipiri pa killere rata savana. Didi chipiri pa killere rata bato. Didi chipiri pa killere rata savana. Your love and your cares, oh Africa, how beautiful you are.
Music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor William Eagle and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the hunter does not rub himself in oil and lie by the fireside to sleep. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.